Yeah. And then it's recording now. Okay. Okay, good. Okay. All right. Yeah, it's recording now. Okay, sharp. Showman. Right. I've been saying many times you couldn't have been able to switch her on.
Codes of conduct, I think, is a useful title for us to work with in this context. Who and what do codes of conduct do? They generally provide direction to a whole range of different people about their activities or responsibilities, either within a business or an organisation, or as a stakeholder who interacts with that business or organisation. They reflect ethical principles in the large part, so most of this about ethics or moral standards, though some can contain non-ethical procedural directives. It was asked this morning who establishes or who monitors or who uses codes of conduct, and there's very many different options to doing this. Often they are done by a business itself. Many, particularly larger firms or medium-sized firms as well, will have their own internal codes to govern the activities of their employees, their board of directors, how they interact with stakeholders and so on. You can also have codes at an industry and sector level or within professional bodies. That's very common. I'm sure some of you probably have signed up to various codes at different points in time in your careers. There's also the global business codes, which are put together by groups of businesses at an international level. So you have the International Chambers of Commerce, for example, brings together chambers of commerce from around the world, and they have codes that cover their interactions. You can have imposed codes prepared by governments, not quite so common. And then probably the most widely used is those prepared by international organisations that apply to the activities. But we've also put there that these days you can quite frankly have a code proposed by almost anybody. You can have internet warriors, sports administrators, lobby groups, you know, fair trade tourism can put forward the codes of conduct, and health alliances is another big area where you're seeing much more. So wherever there's sort of a social movement, you might get suggestions of some kind of code of practice or good behaviour. Why are codes becoming more and more talked about and more important? I think because of this issue of competition. It was mentioned this morning the scramble for Africa's resources, which is just one example happening in our neighbourhood. But there is intense pressures around competition and globalisation that I think are making it more and more important for businesses to be seen to be responsible and to act responsibly wherever possible. I think we're also seeing the influence of the mega companies, you know, companies that are richer than most countries. If you're talking about, for example, a company the size of Walmart, which is one that has recently entered into the South African market, considerably big, extremely influential, particularly in the sphere of operations of retail in which it works. There's also a repositioning, I think, of the government and what its roles are in relation to private sector interactions that is happening globally. More and more economic diplomacy is also becoming about directly corporate diplomacy or commercial diplomacy as well. And this is playing out as governments in many countries seek to either assist or directly promote the corporate interests of their firms. There's a war for talent, so the more that you can provide ethical guidance and assistance for professionals, the more appealing you might be as a company. There's also the growth of civil society, social movements, and activism as a whole. Do codes work? I think this is probably one of the most critical issues for a group of people like yourselves and the committee here, because this, I think, comes down to the crux of what do we do about this idea floating around of a code for South African companies. And quite frankly, it's a bit debatable as to whether codes actually work. And this is largely because they are voluntary. So their enforcement, their monitoring and so on can be quite difficult. And so in many instances, it may become simply a case of wishful thinking of what you've put down on paper, sort of more aspirational than real in many instances. However, if the code can be made to function properly, is adhered to, and actually does inform the decisions of those it's intended to influence, then you can actually see a definite improvement in the relationship, particularly between government and business, where government is involved in the code. It can improve trust, it can build credibility, and it can facilitate the flows of information. There are challenges, however, in making codes work. Many require a self-review, a self-regulatory approach, as was also mentioned this morning. And that means you have to be prepared to do honest analysis and to disclose information. And this can be difficult for some companies, particularly operating at the moment in highly competitive environments. There's also the need for future casting in many codes. How do you design codes that really talk to not only operations now, but what's potentially going to be the issues in the future? Many codes are continuously reviewed. The OECD is continuously looking at its multinational corporations' codes because they find that there are new issues all the time coming onto the agenda for how businesses operate, and you have to be able to amend and deal with those different practices. There are codes, if we're going to look particularly at codes that are not general in their application but are specific in their location. For example, at one point there was talk about a code of conduct for South African companies operating in Zimbabwe before the government of national unity and whilst it was still under a difficult regime of the ZANU-PF administration. And if that's going to happen, then you do have to be particularly sensitive to the foreign policy implications. And in the case of a bilateral code, what that means for that relationship. And quite frankly, I think this is something that I would warn against and caution when we're looking at a code for South African companies in particular. South Africa can be perceived as arrogant by members of the rest of the African continent. And if we shape a code and we present a code in a way that is seen to suggest that there are not sufficient domestic regulations already in place in other African countries for them to manage the conduct of private sector firms, then we could be exacerbating that perception. And it could be, in fact, seen as quite a patronising approach. So I think that has to be weighed up very carefully and how we present some of these ideas. Because one of the keys is that you have to respect sovereignty of other partners. And most countries do have in place forms of regulation and means to govern the behaviour of their investors. So you do not want to be in any way putting forward a code that could be perceived as saying, we know better than you do what should be done in your national environment. So that would be a word of warning I would make with regards to how these ideas can be presented, particularly in regard to our relationship with the rest of Africa. There are numerous existing codes, and this is what starts to worry me when we begin to talk about more codes, is we already have a vast collection of codes of conduct, and these all apply in some way to South African firms. There are the ILO conventions, which specifically deal with labour standards, as you are well aware, but they also look at multinational corporations and the activities of larger companies. There's the UN Global Compact, which in South Africa is sort of housed, if you like, or the focal point for it is the NBI, the National Business Initiative. There's the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which covers human rights aspects globally. We have the OECD guidelines, which I mentioned, the NPAD Business Foundation has a set of four covenants for its members. And this is around, I haven't checked the latest count, but around 40 of South Africa's companies that are investing in other African countries. There's also a social charter at the SADC level, and of course we have the King Code. And King Code 3 took that extra step, if you like, and moved to an extraterritorial application for JSE-listed companies of certain aspects of the requirements that are set out in that code. So as you can see, we already have quite an extensive body of guiding ideals, guiding purposes, that I would suggest cover thousands of South African companies, quite frankly, either directly or indirectly. And they all have some common themes that I think we can draw out. They talk about compliance with local laws and regulations. Very straightforward, most important point. Anti-corruption, major feature. Labour standards. So no child labour, for example, is a very common feature in all of these codes. A preference for local procurement of supplies, as well as in some cases the local procurement of labour where it's available. Protection of consumer health and safety, of human rights, the need for due diligence and reporting and processes of the interactions of the company. Support for national development priorities, which I think is a critical element for all South African firms, as well as references to corporate social responsibility and making sure that these are effective. Not all of these points are in all of the codes I've mentioned, but I think that these could be taken out as the common ideas of what you would want to see if you were going to put together a new code and what you can learn from what's already existing. There is an initiative by the South African government, which was referred to this morning. You know the history better than I do. There was a resolution or part of the resolutions from the Polokwane ANC conference which referred to the activities of South African companies, particularly in the rest of the continent, that called for a code of conduct. This was taken up and put into the DIRCO work plan. And then, as I understand it, the DTI were asked in their role as sort of the lead department and interacting with the private sector to lead this process. And they have prepared a draft. It's currently called guidelines, from what I can gather. So it's moved from being a code to guidelines. And the last version that I have seen from the DTI was dated November last year. And I don't know whether there's a further iteration yet or not. But this was a document that was discussed with some business organisations and some companies to get initial feedback for a possible code. And I wanted to just pull out some of the things that I think are interesting in that draft document by the DCI. The focus is very strongly on operations in the rest of the African continent, not beyond. And the context in which they've placed this development is with a view to South Africa being the largest investor in the continent, if you take out the oil and gas sector. And it recognises strongly the need for greater cooperation between government and the private sector. It's voluntary. And interestingly, the way that they envisage in the draft from November last year it operating was that this would be done through business organisations or business formations. And that raises some very interesting questions, which we can get to a bit later. There was a monitoring mechanism also proposed, which I found quite interesting, of using South African embassies on the continent as national contact points in the host country for people to go to if they had either compliments or complaints about the operations of South African business. And so they were envisaging quite a specific task, if you like, for our diplomats abroad. Which I think is quite an innovative thought. The code covers corporate governance as well as corporate social responsibility activities, and at its heart seems to be an aim which seeks to apply South African regulatory standards to the rest of the continent. That's where I have a bit more of a problem. That's a very strongly made point by COSATU and other trade unions, that this is how, in their view, South African corporates should be operating. It's slightly conflictual, in my view, with the overarching theme of most codes and the main principle of most codes, which is that companies should adhere to domestic laws and regulations. So I think we need to think quite carefully about how these two ideas can be married and what it means to bring them together. So some of the points I'd like to just highlight in concluding, for me, I think maybe talking about a code is taking a step ahead of where we really are right now. And for me, the biggest recommendation I can make, and one that I would certainly voice to anybody who listens, is that simply we need more and more interaction in this country between government and business. And this includes specifically Parliament, organised labour and civil society organisations to be there comprehensively. Because I think that there's a real lack of understanding, a real lack of communication around the activities of the private sector, and also how they relate to national objectives of the South African government. DIRCO has not been particularly good in its outreach to business in the past. I think that this is slowly starting to change, but it's not something that I see diplomats feeling naturally inclined towards, if you like. And it's something that I think we really need to consciously foster, is the engagement of business much more in our international relations debates and space. So that is just simply my leading recommendation. I think business is particularly slack in its communication about what it already does with regards to responsible behaviour on the rest of the continent in particular. I think that, as the Chair mentioned this morning, the vast majority of South African companies are operating responsibly and are doing good things, but we tend not to hear about it very much. It may be buried deep in an annual report that they are doing something really amazing with regards to the development of local supply chains, for example, in another African country. And all we see, really, is the negative coverage. You know, the ShopRite has a labour dispute in Zambia or something. That will make a headline. But the flip side of the more positive success stories. Transparency International did an assessment once, about 3 or 4 years ago, looking at investors on the African continent. South African investors came out as by far the most responsible compared to other investors from other countries. And so I think that whilst I'm not downplaying the bad apples and the impact that that can have on perceptions in particular, I think we have to be much more clear in our PR, if you like, and that's something that the private sector can do. I'm sure you might be aware that the NEDLAT processes have been discussing these issues for a number of years now, and they have recently awarded the tender for a freight study which looks specifically at issues around perception and operations of South African companies on the continent. And in my point of view, this is a good start for a piece of research that will be able to be discussed by a wide range of stakeholders through NEDLAT, and it's actually long overdue. I think there's a need to be very clear on what already exists before we move forward with any new proposals for codes. And if we are going to start to involve specifically embassies and diplomatic staff in monitoring and interactions with the private sector more directly, which is what is proposed in the current draft, then I think we need to make sure we upscale the skills of our government officials in this regard. And last year, for the first time, DIRCO outsourced some of its internal training for its cadets, and it was specifically on economic diplomacy, and we were asked to facilitate the training course for the DIRCO cadets on this. And it was a very interesting process for us to go through to talk to these young, aspiring diplomats, because I think the recognition coming from DIRCO is we all know that the DTI struggles to find the resources to fill all of the trade attaché posts that we need in South Africa around the world. There are many vacancies. The budget was cut a couple of years back for TISA to fill some of these positions. And so as a result, there are fewer and fewer trade officials posted abroad on behalf of South Africa. And so the economic responsibilities are becoming greater on our diplomatic staff. We were teaching a group of 39 cadets last year at DIRCO. None of them were economists. None. There was lawyers and there was international relations people, but nobody had a degree or even an undergraduate understanding of economics. And my last point, I think, is support for strong organized business. And this is a major challenge right now in South Africa. And if there's anything that Parliament can do to understand and to assist in the struggle that has happening between our national business bodies, then please do so, because it's necessary to have organised business structures to engage on policy issues and to engage on policy debates. It's not possible for government to speak individually to every single firm that is investing or trading with the rest of the continent. There has to be some mechanism to filter this interaction and this engagement. And that is where your organised business bodies come into play. Just a little plug for what SIA does in this space. We've got two publications which I will send through to the committee that are recent. One is Working for Development in Southern Africa, Bridging the Gaps Between Government and Business, which has quite a few recommendations along the lines of what I've highlighted today. And then I wrote a piece last year called, for Standard Bank in fact, called State Visits as a Tool of Economic Diplomacy, Bandwagon or Business Sense. And it's based on my experience of about 15 state visit business delegations with President Zuma and what I think could be done better and in that process. We as an organisation provide support to the SADC Secretariat, who is trying to build up a better public-private dialogue process right now and is making some good progress there. Last year we did a mapping of all African private sector organisations and bodies for the African Development Bank, who are hoping to set up a platform for engaging the private sector on African development issues. And in this last week and next week, we're launching a series of firm-level case studies about how companies see doing business in the SADC region. What are their real issues? What are their real challenges? And that involves about 15 South African companies in that process. So we'd be happy to talk about any of these things in a related manner as well, because I think they're all part of your economic diplomacy mandate. But I look forward to questions, and sorry, Dr. Zandi, for going over. Do you need this card? No.
Okay, leave that there. That's fine. Thanks, Catherine. Good morning to you all, Mr. Chairman, honourable members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for the opportunity of spending some time with you this morning on this very important issue of the way in which our corporates behave when they operate in other jurisdictions around the world. One of the potential dangers in batting number three in a lineup of three is that the previous speakers have an ability to chip away at some of the content that you had prepared. Not that I could ever pretend to live or exist or understand the dark, shady, and sexy world of private security companies, but Catherine certainly covered some of the material that I'd hoped to cover, and I won't repeat that. My presentation is not meant to be instructive, but merely to share some of our experience at Standard Bank, where we operate, and hopefully provide some provocative thoughts for a discussion that follows this presentation. To give our organization some context, I think it's important to note that Standard Bank will be 150 years old this year. It was in May 150 years ago that we established our first branch in the coastal city of Port Elizabeth. We currently operate in 30 countries around the world, employ 53,000 people. We operate in 17 countries in sub-Saharan Africa, and we are Africa's largest bank by market capitalization, by assets, and by value. Our mission in life and what we intend to do is to connect Africa to the rest of the world and the rest of the world to Africa. We believe in the importance of good, well-behaved corporate citizens, and it is certainly something that we aspire to and something that we actively encourage each and every one of our 50-odd thousand people to aspire to. There is no room for any intransigence or flexibility, basically an approach of zero defect. And that is an important part of our values. We will not countenance the over-exuberant persuasion in order to further business goals. It's absolutely imperative in everything that we do. Catherine covered the various codes of conduct that exist around the world, from the OECD that has put a lot of time into this, the UN and the UN Global Compact, and the various business codes of conduct which exist, codes of conduct especially in the South African context. She also provided some political context with the pronouncements that came out of Polokwane and then the focus in the most recent Durco annual report on a view that a voluntary code of good business practice be developed in conjunction with a wide range of role players, including academic institutions, BUSA, national departments, etc. And I think the point that she made about cooperation and communication between government and business in this particular area is paramount. I think business is often tardy at what it communicates. It tends to communicate too narrowly to a group of shareholders, and government, and certainly Durco in our lives, is a very important stakeholder that we need to make sure that we continue frequent and meaningful communication with Durco so that we understand each other better. And that really is the reason for my presence and sharing some time with you here this morning. Our policies at Standard Bank are generally and already aligned with various elements of the numerous codes that exist, and Catherine very comprehensively listed those. We also, in compliance with King 3, publish a detailed annual sustainability report, which assesses the extent to which the bank is a responsible corporate citizen. This report covers our impact on society and the environment and outlines our CSI and corporate citizen policies and programs. We have our own code of ethics, which is distributed to every single individual in the Standard Bank Group. It's also a public document and available to all interested parties. And in terms of this code of ethics, what we try and do is set out a set of guidelines in terms of which we attempt to live our values. And like many corporates around the world, we have a set of values that we have communicated widely, and we encourage people in their daily activities and in the daily fabric of what we do to include these values. And just going through these quickly, serving customers, determining customer needs, providing excellent service and products, being fair and providing secure banking. One of our values is growing our people. In terms of this, we provide professional development, we evaluate performance objectively, and apply Standard Bank principles and values. We believe it's important to deliver to our shareholders. We are proactive, we work in teams, we respect each other, and importantly in this context, we believe it's important to uphold the highest levels of integrity, honesty, avoiding conflicts of interest, avoiding bribery, and combating and reporting unethical and criminal activities. That's very important. So, for example, in all of our operations, we have a very active hotline which is an anonymous telephone number where people who suspect any type of unethical or even a criminal activity can make a phone call, report an instance, and that will be then be taken up at the highest level and independently within our group. Our code of ethics outlines a variety of ways to report unethical conduct. As I said, the ethics and fraud hotline, the various human resources departments, we have business and ethics officers in our operations, and we have departments of group financial crime control and the group ethics officer. We have a group sustainability management program, which takes a consistent approach to environmental and social management by facilitating policy, systems, performance standards, monitoring and assurance within the group's operations and financing. And we are signatories to the Equator Principles on project finance. We signed the Equator Principles in 2009, and our bank was elected to the Global Equator Principles Steering Committee, which was the first and only African bank to be elected in 2010. This principle commits the bank to avoiding or mitigating negative social and environmental effects of projects that we finance. We have very active corporate social responsibility and social investment programs, and the developmental impact of going about our business in the rest of Africa and connecting Africa to the world is something that we continue to assess on an ongoing basis. We believe that any code or initiative to improve the level of good corporate governance is something that should be encouraged, and we would support that as Standard Bank. We do, however, understand, and we would like the committee to understand, that this could be a competitive issue. We would therefore be somewhat concerned if any code was implemented which sought to bind South African corporates, which as a consequence of this introduce a negative competitive issue as against other international corporates. The area in which we operate, banking and financial services, is indeed a global industry. The banks that we compete against in the 17 sub-Saharan African countries that we compete in, by the way, soon to be 18, as we seek to open an operation in South Sudan, which is very encouraging, the banks against which we compete are the major, major international banks. And it's important that there is a level playing field as we go about our respective business. Banking is also a very well-regulated business. Apart from the initiatives coming out of Basel, and we're now into Basel III, which seeks to regulate the amount of capital that is required in order to ensure a stable banking system, we are the subject of what we call our home regulator and our host regulator. So our home regulator is the South African Reserve Bank, and in each of the countries that we operate, we have a host regulator. In terms of this, to give you an example, all minutes of board meetings, subcommittee meetings of the various boards need to be submitted to both the home and the host regulator. Everything that is discussed is therefore open for their inspection. And as an example, we may not approve an individual or appoint an individual to one of our subsidiary boards without, first of all, the SARB, the South African Reserve Bank approval, and the host regulator, to the extent that that individual is a fit and proper person. And we have, on some occasions, had a decline in terms of which the regulator, for no reason or explanation, says we don't believe this person is fit and proper. So banking is a highly regulated industry. We also seek to ensure that our customers are of significant good social and commercial standing. We would not like to be linked to some of the more nefarious and criminal organizations that exist out there. So we have a number of regulatory requirements that you might be familiar with, even in your own particular circumstances, KYC, which is Know Your Customer, in terms of which you are expected and required to supply your physical address, your ID document, copy of your last life and water account, etc. All of this in the interest of anti-money laundering, anti-funding of illicit terrorist organizations, blood diamonds, etc., etc. I question also whether a code could be feasibly a one-size-fits-all. Is there an opportunity to differentiate either sector by sector, industry by industry, and as Catherine said, there was talk of a code for Zimbabwe. We would welcome such a code, provided it had the antithesis on the other side of the equation that the government may not annex any of our particular properties, which is something that we all battle with at the moment, and I'm sure you've seen Impala Platinum, the very preeminent South African mining company, is dealing with at the moment. So perhaps some thought to some segmentation or differentiation, because I'm not sure that a one-size-fits-all would be appropriate, and a consequence of that might be dilution to such an extent that the code or the guidelines don't really mean anything, and that would be a pity and a futile exercise. So in summary, we are prepared and committed to share our experiences, to enter dialogue, participate in workshops, with DIRCO and any of its substructures in order to hopefully reach some sensible consensus agreement between business and government as to what is appropriate as we try and ensure that South African companies are regarded as the best possible corporate citizens wherever they might operate. Thank you. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you very much, Clive, and thank you very much, Catherine. At this point, we open the floor again for questions or comments or other forms of interventions, and I would like you to indicate that to me by show of hand, and then I see one hand, and I see another board, and three hands. Can you take them in that order? I'm not sure where the mic is.
Oh, yeah.
Can I start with you, madam? And then the gentleman down the path. Sure. Thank you, madam. Let me start with madam. Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much, also, for this presentation. The question is to, the first question is to Mr. Bose. I've seen the list of everything that you have shown there. I have not seen or pardon me if I missed it, something in the presentation that relates to your application of all of them. So I'd like to see that. And then second one that's related to that is in showing us how you apply this. It would be helpful and useful to present to us also your own statistics of both what you term good behavior and bad behavior. Because I think in us deliberating this, we would want to get to the situation where we cannot continue with assumptions. Either way. And so I think that if we need to install any further regulation, codes, legislation, whatever we want to, we've got to be mindful of what the landscape is out there. So I think if that could be assisted, if you could assist us with that. In particular, we imagine that you could talk to us about the avoidance of breaking the law, the avoidance of actions that result in civil lawsuits, and also the avoidance of actions that are bad for your... It's not just your image, because it will be the business from South Africa, and in South Africa one carries more weight than the business, you see, because the South Africa part is related more to the government, and there are less emphasis on the fact that it is a business. So if you could help us with that. I thought the one issue that you raised pattern which you think is the bit of a difficulty that wants to be applied. I think you mentioned the unit in particular wants it to be applied. I think that stems from the fact that these things derive out of the ILO also. And so standardization of anything is not just a South African voice, but a global voice of applying. And precisely so, because I think what we would battle with in South Africa is the fact that we say that we need to create jobs, and then we would find people feeling that this is lucrative to go to, because there you can pay 10 rand and whatever currency is. And so I think those morality and ethical issues is what we are also interested in, because if you say that it's far better to go to the Swaziland where nothing going there, then I think it is obviously that you will cause that voice to become stronger in saying that there needs to be a particular application of the law. I sympathize with what you said on more interaction. And what I fail to understand is, for both of you, is the interaction at NEDLAC is that not sufficient. You would do this to say quite a long time then. Is that not sufficient? And maybe you should tell us what type of interaction is that you are calling for. Because in our instance, we would deal with legislation most of the time, we would second meeting and so on. What specific interaction is that you are talking about? And I can only wish you well with the fear that you've made on bringing unity in the business sector. We can talk about it off the record on how to assist that. And at the end of, I hope you support the Springbok now.
Yes, yeah, gentlemen, thank you so much.
Sorry, I just want to ask a question, just want to say something. I've been traveling to Africa for many years with friends, and I must admit, Standard Bank, especially the last couple of years, changed banking in Africa. It's accessible, and my friends are not banking Standard Bank, and I always have to help them out.
I've been to a delicious.
A couple of years ago, you think. Well, I was talking about beers.
Remember,
you're
not supposed to be looking for a job at
Tasker. Sorry, and I don't sorry, just before I came out, I don't even know what it is. And talking about beer, Tasker is the name of you because it's one of the favorite beers in Africa. So, really, I must congratulate you on that. And then the recent Hawking scandal, Standard Bank was the only bank that wasn't mentioned that had to do something with this Hawking scandal. So, I just want to congratulate you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There was a hand on another one.
Oh. Yeah. Standard Bank is indeed one of the good apps. Thank you for the opportunity. I want to ask a question regarding to the what you referred to earlier, regarding the various codes that are there that are in place. Now, is these codes in themselves sufficient? Naturally, there would not have been a need identified for a code to be brought. Because clearly those codes are not sufficient in themselves, and I suspect that part of the problem is precisely their applicability, the monitoring, and possible non-existence or non-applicability of any sanctions regime, that may or may not be in the Australia, of course, the media by the freedom. So, and as such, companies well didn't have to conform in many ways. So I'm just saying that purely from the perspective of expecting companies to adhere simply out of goodwill and work. And as such, such a need was now. So your comments on that, I would very much love to hear your comments on that. And then the what is up? Well, there is at first glance a contradiction between the host country, versus domestic law and applicability. Again, I heard your comments about it, but I'm very much interested to know what you propose in terms of navigating that apparent contradiction. Because I earlier spoke about it, and I mindful of that potential contradiction. Actually, try to perhaps circumvent it, if you wish, by saying by referring to minimum requirements. As opposed to an emphasis on what is on the legal, contradiction between what may be domestic law and what may be. But correctly, as the Honourable Member pointed out, there are universal standards set out by the ILO, But in spite of this, some South African companies, and I want to repeat the point that most, at least reportedly, most South African companies are being bought. And I don't think we should ever get, lose sight of that. So when we speak, we should always be mindful that there are some really that are not doing as good as they should. And those are the ones really, actually, for which the code is meant. It's not meant for those who comply. For those who do not. So then lastly, your comment on that as well. And then lastly, you raised a very important thing. We actually spoke about it earlier, myself and Dr. Zondi, that this code, whatever it does, whatever it does, it should not put South African companies on the way, where they must compete already with the disadvantage. Because that indeed would be detrimental to the very object of our foreign policy. In fact, it would be defeated, in my view, because then we won't be able to achieve our domestic, our own domestic. Because remember, again, we depart from the premise that our foreign policy is an extension of our domestic policy, and as such, is meant to help us meet our domestic priorities. And so, if this is going to curtail South African business doing business in Africa, then we might very well not even look into a code of conduct, because then it would be defeated. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I saw a hand over that side.
Thank you. I would just ask Mr. Tasker. The companies that the chair and others are worried about impacting negatively on the image of South Africa, etc. They're not likely to respond to a code of conduct either, I should imagine. But just in your experience, obviously, regulations that would impact on your being competitive or companies being competitive would be problematic. And so you would want to narrow it down to just whatever the problem companies are, what would their, what would the consequences be? What would the consequences, what should the consequences be for those companies who are the culprits, rather than us doing something now that will interfere and impact me? Is there anything that comes to mind, and where should we be looking for that kind of solution?
Thank you very much. Is there another hand? Oh, an additional.
Thank you again for the moderator. There's just two things. The one is, I'd really like your view of handing out these proceedings. And then the second one would be, you know, after the predestination address, and the entire infrastructure pronouncement, I can tell you that very many committees have had, not committees, chairpersons, or whatever, have had very many visits from very many different people wanting to see some clarity on what is that. And let me first of all ask, because of the kind of, it's not the first time that the government talks about infrastructure rollout, it's a continuation. This one has got, emphasis on particular sectors. What is your response to the fact that there's a big chunk of private sector involvement in this? And are there any, over and above what you told us now, are there any discussions amongst yourselves that talks about how particular conduct would occur? I'm raising this because there's been quite a bit of flurry to Parliament. We'd like to discuss, we'd like to hear, we'd like to talk about the nuclear noise and all of this. And I get very worried about that, because that means, there could be unintended consequences of just a little visit. I mean, the President was very clear, why would we need extra visits to talk about that? I'm saying this because it's not just South Africa, it's also between South Africa and outside of the country. So you would have a team of ambassadors that would like to come to visit members of Parliament to continue to ask the government. So what guidance are you given in this instance around that? I thought on the media, I thought that, as they are companies also, I thought that there would be a relationship in how they are being brought in conversation with yourself about what you have spoken about earlier on, as a business entity, because they are business more than anything else. And they argue that this is derived from negative publicity, but the consequences of what all of us are suffering. So I'd really like to know, do you have that kind of relationship with you at that level? Thank you for the second opportunity to share.
Thank you very much. I guess at this point, we give an opportunity to the two colleagues to respond. I'm not sure who wants to start, to go first. Catherine.
The application of all these is in terms of who they apply to or what sectors, that is something that is readily available as information with regards to the code. You can find out which companies have signed on to the Union Global Compact how the OECD multinational corporations guidelines work and who participates. And there's a very broad range of South African companies in all of these different processes. We could prepare you a detailed list if that would be helpful. It's not something I can cover in a short presentation like this. The point is that they are very broad ranging and they do apply to a whole different set of companies that come from various sectors in the South African context. South African companies are not shy from signing up to these kind of codes. As I think explained, standards, I would guess, would probably adhere almost all of them, and so would almost all of the larger corporates, particularly those that are listed publicly on stock exchanges. I think that that really possibly differentiates. If it's not a publicly listed company, then they may have different requirements for these shareholders, which could see them not necessarily adhering to all of the existing codes. I think one of the biggest challenges in this whole debate is the lack of real statistics and understanding of some of these issues. It is very difficult to give actual replies on how many South African companies are good and how many are bad, and what are the interactions out there. Investment is a notoriously foggy area, and getting concrete facts about who is investing, how much, where, in which countries, and who are they competing against from other parts of the world, it's extremely difficult to do. And I think that that's actually, for me, what this bridge study that they're doing in NEDLAC at the moment will be useful for, because they are attempting to do that quantitative analysis for, I think, the top 10 countries for South African FDI on the continent. So they're not taking all of the 53 or 54 countries, but they are taking at least the top destination countries for South African industries right now, and trying to exactly give you some of those figures and statistics. Because I fully agree with you that if we are going to be moving forward in this debate, we need to come from an informed position. And I think that this whole image perception thing is really interesting, because there's two things when I travel that strike me, that your average person will mention. One is the South African company that they interact with. That will be their perception. So maybe the Nando's that they go to every week for their ticket on Saturday, or maybe a Standard Bank providing their banking services. That is their frontline interaction with South Africa, meaning if you're an average African citizen. Your second interaction will be with an embassy to apply for a visa in Greece. And that is a whole other series of issues. It's the perceptions and the problems that we have in our treatment of other Africans with regards to visa and home affairs. So I agree with you that I don't think sometimes, for example, Spice Tank Brand or Nando's sit there and really think about the fact that they are the front face of the South African brand in some of these countries. You know, and this is just an example. I'm just using Nando's as an example, but yeah, I don't know how many business people really go into these markets with that idea and they see that we have to be responsible, we have to treat ourselves as a national flag bearer. And I think that needs to be much more clearly communicated and discussed with people like Clive, who are the operations people for these African businesses. The whole conflict issue which came up in the contradiction between how do you navigate post-country regulations and laws versus South African regulations. This goes directly, when you're talking about labour standards, to questions of competitiveness, unfortunately. Some of the competitive advantages of operating in other countries, as you rightly said, is lower cost of wage, or lower cost of labour, whether it be wage rate, or whether it be benefits required, or other issues. So it's not only a matter of ILO conventions, which I think we would all accept should be the basis of whatever is in a code in this area, but it is a competitiveness factor that needs to be treated very carefully as a result. And when you talk to, for example, some of the retailers who have operations in the region, they have voluntarily agreed to pay South African minimum wages in some of the neighbouring countries. It is, for example, paying the same minimum wage in South Africa as right in Africa, and I think possibly even into the world climate. And so they've voluntarily decided to do that because they believe that that will be the best thing for themselves and their workers. It becomes difficult, though, to impose, I think, minimum regulations without drilling down prepared client says into sector level detail. I think it would be very hard. And even then, that would be an extremely poor process of negotiation. And I don't know how much value it would actually add in the end. I think for me, the question is about what are our principles to start with, what are our core values of South Africans and South African business, and then also looking at the host country. If we think that the host country is struggling in some of these areas, isn't it a better approach to team South Africa to maybe offer assistance and engagement with our African colleagues so that they can improve their overall regulatory environment? And I think that that's something that missed sometimes from this debate, is that we are looking at this solely from the angle of South African firms or what South African activities are undertaken in these countries. But surely we could ask some of the firms that are already engaging in these markets, what can you do to assist in improving the regulatory environment in other African countries? And that would not only benefit the concerns we have about South African businesses, but it would benefit overall and avoid some of these issues around competitiveness. So, I mean, that's an idea that I would throw out there. And, I mean, the competitiveness issue, and we, you know, the point is that we don't want to make this to the detriment of South African companies. How about we talk about a BRICS code then? Why don't we even think a bit more broadly about these things? If we generally agree that this is an area where South African corporates behave relatively well as a whole, and there may be some that don't, why don't we try and set some standards and some principles that could be applied by our BRICS colleagues? I've never seen this before, so this is entirely off the top of my head, but that would potentially also then move away from some of the concerns that may exist with other problems. You are absolutely right that the problem companies are not going to be the ones that come to the consultations on the code, and they're not going to be the ones that sign up and so on. And this comes back to the key issue with why these ISIC codes don't work, and that is enforcement mechanisms. And you have to think very carefully about this. A code of its nature is voluntary. It's not legally binding. So you have to put on your thinking cap whether that will actually then achieve your goals or not, or whether we're looking at different types of mechanisms. And the one set of principles that we haven't really talked about today much, but which I think were possibly some of the most effective and from a historical point of view, were the Sullivan principles that applied to corporates doing business under apartheid South Africa. And they had the most detailed list of minimum standards and requirements that I think you would see in any previous code. They have not been replicated in the more general global ones. And I think that's because they were applicable to a very specific circumstance. But I mean, there's one on that we haven't looked back at, and perhaps it might be worth thinking about as to whether there's anything in there that could be changed. And then the other set of issues we haven't talked about, which I think are worth mentioning and for you to bear in mind, are also what's set out under the Black Empowerment, Economic Empowerment, the Board-based Black Economic Empowerment requirements in South Africa. A lot of that does deal to a certain extent with good corporate governance, good corporate responsibility, and I think are worth considering. And what we're seeing now, obviously in the rest of the region, and Clive alluded to it, is different types of empowerment activities taking place in many other African countries. And I think that that's something that needs to be borne in mind, is whether or not you would want a code to reflect some of those issues, you know, including things like skills development and so on. So I'll throw those in to the mix. Gifts, I don't have a point of view on. we like them in our house, and yeah, I can understand your question. NEDLAC, I have a very strong point of view on. I think it's completely insufficient in terms of its interaction. I think it's a strong and good organisation on some points, but I don't think it really is structured to allow for proper exchanges between different groups of stakeholders. It's a very formalized way of operating anything. You know, and I'm sure many of you have been to me that meeting.
One
you
minute.
You spend the first hour going back over the minutes of the last meeting. And this puts off almost immediately any real business participation to start. And even some of the government officials that come, you know, won't come back because they find that the processes are so formalized and don't allow for proper interaction. And so I think it works, particularly if you're dealing with a piece of draft legislation or something like that, where it's a very structured level of discussion that you need to have. But I think if you're wanting to have a platform for understanding each other better and better, it's not just that.
Thank you so much. Can we get a mic over to Clive?
Thank you very much, Mr. Moderator. Catherine has dealt with many of the issues. I will add my 5 cents to it, and where I disagree, also say so, but there are not many of those instances. The applicability of the code, I think many corporates have many signatories to many of these codes, and that tends to result in a long list of the codes, which probably appears in the annual report. Where I think these codes really become meaningful is when the corporate takes the best or the highest standards out of the variety of codes and then coalesces them into their own code. And that becomes the code of that particular corporate. And you can judge the corporate in terms of its own code of ethics, code of conduct, value system, etc. The statistics issue, you have made the point, and I think it's something that some independent body should become involved in, maybe something like her organization, etc., to report on transgression non-compliance. If we actually, at NEDVAC, I think NEDVAC has a role to play, but I think that we need other institutions, other activities to augment what happens there. The point of South African companies and South African arrogance is an interesting one, because I was just thinking, we have large banks in Zimbabwe and Malawi. We have the third largest bank in Zimbabwe, employs 750 people. And there's not one South African in that 750 strong workforce, the workforce. So the challenge we have is to take our brand, our mode of operation, our code of conduct, ethics, and our value system, and in a way, hopefully, get the local employees of our bank in Zimbabwe to own that, and behave in a way that they service the customer, but hopefully have the good and best corporate practices that we bring to bear. You know, the age-old saying, local is Mecca type of situation. The same in Malawi. We have a significant bank there that employs 900 people, and I'm aware of two that are not Malawians. And then you've got to ask yourself, is that bank a South African bank? Is it a Malawian? What is it? Notwithstanding that, the necessity for a minimum level code, internal or otherwise, is important and is there. The applicability of the codes, the point you've made, you know, if they're working, then why are we talking about it? Well, the cynic in me says there are lots of really good laws out there and people still break them. So, you know, we need to make sure that they are up to date, up to speed, communicated, etc. And we might have more type of mayhem or Armageddon without the codes. But I think it's something that can be improved upon. The question of the conflict between host and home country, we have a very simple principle that we apply here, and that is we apply the higher or the more stringent standards. So to give an example, we have capital requirements. For example, in South Africa, our capital requirement is 12.5%, and we operate in many countries on the continent where the capital requirement is 15% for a local bank, then the capital requirement is 15%. And I think in most instances, you can, after some reasonably thorough analysis, come to a conclusion as to what is the most stringent requirement, and that is what we do, and that's what we apply. So there's no attempt to go to the lowest common denominator. In fact, in the country, we would default to the highest common denominator. So we cannot be criticized by either host or home for being in contradiction. We're always higher than the lowest bar. The issue of competition, certainly I made the point, and there was something that was made earlier this morning about where should responsibility for these codes lie or vest. And, you know, as an example, the African Union was mentioned. Now, I'm not proposing that for a moment, but some overarching body, which is the recipient of these companies, rather than the country that sends these companies out. So if you have in sub-Saharan Africa, American companies, French companies, European companies, Latin American companies operating, they all should hopefully be subject to the same code and requirements. The consequences, you know, the bad companies kind of hope that they'll just get away with it. And I think that something along the name and shame type of approach can be powerful. Some register that's held somewhere where people who have transgressed or are not compliant are listed, and interested parties can go and can, that becomes something of a public or part of public record. And of course, in the high profile instances, these things become newsworthy, as we've seen in the recent expose in the auction industry. It becomes very newsworthy. And so thank you for your complimentary comments. I must say, being an international bank is not an easy profession. There are not a lot of compliments that fly around, so when they do, they gratefully accept it. Thank you. Yeah, they example. Yes. your question about gifts. We have a very clear and straightforward approach to gifts, which correlates to a RAND amount. They all should be reported, and over a certain level they may not be accepted without your supervisor or your immediate manager or leader giving his approval. So I'll give an example which I think is reasonably high profile, has been around in the context of our hosting the World Cup, and these World Cups are all over the place. We would not allow anyone to accept anything above a ticket to a game and immediate hospitality. So some people and companies offered a trip to Auckland, flights included, hotel accommodation included, tickets, etc., and that is just not acceptable. If the counterparty or the customer is important enough in our lives, we will pay for our own official to go there, but all they're allowed to accept is a ticket to the game and a drink afterwards. This is becoming more and more of an issue. I was in Washington, D.C. 2 weeks ago at a corporate hospitality event, and the invitation had three paragraphs at the bottom of it saying, should you accepting this invitation in any way impugn upon your corporate policy, we understand that you may wish to bring your own wine if you want and your own. I thought it was a bit over the top, but that's sort of where the thinking is going. So they said, you know, we don't mind if you want to bring your own. Just make sure it's not better than what we serve. But it is an issue. Hopefully those are the issues that were raised during questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Catherine and Clive. Can give them a round of applause. And Petrus, yes, thank you very much. At this point, I want to hand over to Petrus because my job is done. So it's going to be succession.
Now we are switching roles, and I will keep it short and sweet. Dr. Zondik from the Institute for Global Dialogue, our colleague institution in the same sphere. I think we can welcome you for your segment of the presentation. I think we still have some time before 1 o'clock for lunch, so I think we can stick to the 20 minutes and then some time for questions and comments. So, Dr. Zondi, without any further ado, you can share your thoughts with us.
So I was moving away from here and bringing me back. Thank you very much. Let me just preface this by saying a lot of stuff has been said and a lot of details have been provided by people who know the economics a lot better than I do. I'm not an economist. I don't want to pretend that I'm one. I failed economics at school, or I failed to register economics at school. And my field is really human relations and politics. I'm a foreign policy analyst, so I'm going to try and cover my stuff very quickly and bring in the political dimensions to it that you must always be borne in mind in resolving what seem like merely issues of economic coordination and all of those, when they're actually undergirded by politics and questions of human relations and inter-institutional relations. That's the first point I want to make. The second point I want to make is that options on how South Africa should manage the negative ramifications of its business expansion, especially in Africa, is essentially about what we've decided would be the framework that guides our foreign policy at this point, 17 years down the line. Because it suggests that South Africa has integrated economic diplomacy and commercial diplomacy sufficiently enough to be able to turn the code into something of a useful framework for forcing a common view between business and government in regards to how we participate in African Renaissance. The third point I want to make is that the code also presupposes that we have resolved a very difficult challenge that we've set with over the past 17 years, which is how to find a balance and coherence between our political diplomacy and our economic diplomacy. How to find a good balance between our political objectives and our economic objectives. Simply put, sometimes we say how to find a good balance between our pursuit of great values, which are very broadly social democratic values, and economic interests, which are broadly what we call neoliberal or liberal values. We have to try and push both at the same time. And we often want to close our eyes about it and see how far we go. We just push along, and we want to avoid confronting the fact that the two aren't mutually reinforcing all the time, and that the two of them aren't always harmonized, and that there may be inherent contradictions between the two. The fourth point I want to make is that South Africa has got to a point where it does need to think very carefully about its broad international strategy. It really does have to think very carefully about what its foreign policy framework is going to be going forward. And why is it important? It's important because we've come to a point where it seems to us that what has sustained us over the past 17 years may not be able to sustain us for the next 17 years. Because all analysis of foreign policy, most analysis of foreign policy suggest to us that we've benefited a lot from the iconography of our near miraculous transition that has propelled us to the center stage in the global atmosphere. It made us a fitting candidate for every platform in the world, the last one being BRICS. We are in the G20, we are in the G20, G8 outreach, and all of those. All cold analysis say we don't deserve to be there. But because of the prestige we bring and the political legitimacy that comes with it, we then get invited in all of those things. Our own sense is that we cannot really maintain our global strategy on the basis of luck. We cannot maintain our global strategy on the basis of the fact that we would be attractive even for the next 20 years. People will remember Mandela, will remember miraculous transitions. That increasingly we have become just another small country. That our prestige may dissipate, and that would force us to confront the question in our mind, in the face of it, as to whether we would want to build our hard currency, hard power currencies, like, you know, build an economy to the point where it can be at the par with the likes of Brazil and others, which would be very difficult to do, or we build on our soft power currency, which is what our iconography of Mandela, of our transition, has given us a long time, over the past 17 years. The idea that we've been punching above our weight suggests that our weight is below where we are. But what compensates for it is soft power. But soft power dissipates over a period of time. The one we had is because of our transition. But what are we going to use from now onward? Could business, could economic diplomacy, could networks be part of that? The fifth point I wanted to make is that there's pressure on the foreign policy machinery today to justify its value by providing evidence that it concretely contributes to the domestic agenda, that it concretely leads to creation of employment, to poverty eradication, that it does contribute to improvement of the lives of the people generally. And what the impact of that is that it pushes us into economic diplomacy, sometimes without actually preparing ourselves for economic diplomacy. In other words, pushes us into economic diplomacy without a strategy on economic diplomacy. And that is a challenge, because what it says that we can take big delegations, business delegations on international trips, but if we do not have a framework or a policy on economic diplomacy, we would not be able to manage the unintended consequences. Of course, the intended consequences will manage themselves, because we've committed them, but the unintended consequences would not have a framework for us to do. Very classical example, President Thabo Mbeki takes a big delegation to the DRC, and some of those businesses, especially mining businesses, get involved in illicit trading and get involved in corruption. Of course, then they can go to turn back and say, no, I'm not responsible for that. I just connected them to the other side. But from the DRC side and from the point of view of the UN agencies that investigate these kinds of things, it should be South Africa has done this. But without an economic diplomacy strategy, it is very difficult for us to manage the unintended consequences, therefore. I can foresee that with more delegations going out there, without a framework that kind of firms up the agreement about what is acceptable and not acceptable, rather than assuming it, then there will be unintended consequences, because not every business is honest, just as not every politician is honest. So that is going to be a challenge. The sixth point I want to make is, let me skip this one and then make this one, that domestically there isn't consensus in South Africa, and there is not going to be consensus in South Africa about what would be the right route to take in managing the challenge that we have in front of us, even on what sort of a code we should have. That is partly because South Africa has unfinished nation-building programs. The processes that started in 1994 have not actually been energetically pushed forward to create this rainbow nation. So you have rainbow in potential, but a divided society in reality. And that colors our foreign policy discourse. And our foreign policy discourse is divided right through the middle into what you could call broadly conservative, anti-reform, skeptical of government positions, and broadly radical. We may also be anti-government, but because they're looking for more leftist agenda, more reform, and so on and so on. And these aren't helpful, because it means that South Africa does not establish a certain line that can be drawn, so we can disagree about all sorts of things. But there are certain things we should not disagree about, because we think are critical. And in the absence of that, the discussion of the code becomes a metaphor for other forms of discussions we should have. just as the discussions on the media bill or the secrecy bill or whatever other things are called is a metaphor for things, for discussions we should have that we are not willing to have, probably. And therefore the code itself may be reduced into a technical process, but still does not resolve the issues because, again, there isn't, we haven't got to that discussion. The seventh point I want to make is that the discussions about a code are precipitated by a number of issues. One is an expectation on the African continent that the South African business would behave differently from the global business. That the South African business would be very pan-Africanist, that it would be very African in its outlook, to be a responsible African corporate citizen, that it would be kind of different and humane. As compared to businesses globally. It is a false expectation, but it's an expectation we've sent. If you look at a statement by President Nelson Mandela, which we'll read in the paper when it circulated, he promised Africa in 1994 when he went to speak to the OAU that South Africa would contribute in building a different kind of Mother Africa. That is based on upliftment, on happiness, on prosperity, on comfort for her own children. And the South Africa he was talking about, when it is received in the Congo, when it is received in Angola, it's not distinguished. It's a whole South Africa. So when they receive Standard Bank or receive Anglo-American, they expect them to live up to that promise. So it's quite a lofty one. And that is what leads to a lot of outcry. The second reason for outcry, in my view, may have to do with the fact that the South African business itself promises more than it can deliver. We know for a fact that they put up their regulations in front doors, but the promises they actually make aren't always realistic. They're part of the South African romanticism, idealism and stuff like that. But on the continent, they would expect it to happen, and it does not happen. Another trigger for it is the collapse, in my view, the collapse of conversations between government and business within South Africa, which has reduced NEDLAC and business councils into mere talk shop rather than platforms for serious conversations where the two sides find each other and harmonize their position and work like a team elsewhere. Instead, we have deep mistrust, we have deep gaps between the two, government very suspicious of business and its motivations, and business very aloof and taking what we call independence to mean aloofness. And that is, that opens South Africa up for all sorts of criticism outside. And there's 8 points that has been recorded quite extensively, for example, in the HSRC studies, is a perception on the African continent that there are two faces of South Africa, a black government and a white business. And that a white business is an extension of the colonial Western imperialism. And that perception is also propagated by South Africa's own analysts. If you look at the writings of somebody like Patrick Bond, for example, who talked about the sub-imperialism of South Africa's business, it's quite a lot of writings that have been written by South Africans themselves. They help promote that idea, and it feeds into all of those things. And another point I want to make before the last one is that the globalization has also led to a situation where capital, where multinationals, which we have a lot of in South Africa, and business, have become a lot more significant in regulating international relations than before. Where it used to be nation state that dominate the international system, increasingly it is civil society and big capital. And in that context, the power of government to regulate business is frankly minimal. You have to look at works of Restock, Derek Thompson in the U.S., and the U.S.'s own Congress Committee on Governance Reform, which just suggested, I think out of frustration, that business does not want to be regulated. It listed 3,000 reasons businesses had given for not being regulated. And in the end, the analysis suggests that the frustration comes from the fact that the government does no longer have those wide-sweeping powers to globally and nationally to be able to regulate the other actors who compete for power in this globalized world with it. With this then in mind, then I thought I should just suggest that then there are a few options that South Africa has in responding to this challenge. One has been mentioned here, that you have to look at complementary measures that are national and international. When I say international, I mean regional, continental, and so forth. And that the two would have to be complementary if they were going to work. You need a regional one because it sets a framework that minimizes the potential disadvantage that a compliant country, a compliant business would have if other countries are not complying and other businesses aren't complying. That if they're going to play a boxing game, and other countries will have to play the boxing game using wrestling rules, those countries will have an advantage in a cutthroat competition for economic opportunity. So we need a regional one, as Catherine mentioned earlier on. And you need to build regional regulatory mechanisms, because they could also be used for other purposes, including deepening regional integration in a very concrete sort of way. Then at a national level, you have three options. Either you have a code, in kind of King Code style, which is kind of like binding regulations about how South African business should conduct itself in respect of a number of other things. This would have to be enforced on the basis of obligations that companies have by virtue of their being registered in South Africa, and then there will need to be a specific regulatory institution to monitor and evaluate and report all of this. Disadvantage of it is that it would add a regulatory burden on business, and it would make it very difficult for South African business to compete. The second option is a charter-style code of conduct that is designed to be a tool for engagement to enrich the compact between business and government, force government and business into serious discussions about how they manage each other's expectations from each other and expectations over the African agenda. The purpose of this would be to create and engineer a consensus or find a point of reference for the engagement between the two. The advantage of it is that it could be organic, it could be seen as organic, it could be seen to remedy the issues, the things of that. The last option is merely to put together all the regulations that we know exist, systematize them, and integrate them into one set of documents. In other words, we don't provide additional regulations, but you simply enhance the existing negotiation. You make it easier to enforce them, and you make it easier for business to do that. But as we say that, we must be very careful, because we must be careful not to make two mistakes. One mistake is to assume that the whole thing is merely just about the facts of business conduct in Africa. Of course, there are many facts that show that our business, like other businesses, have not acted well in certain cases. But we know that a lot of this has to do with perceptions, and perceptions do not always relate to facts on the ground or objective conditions, but they are important all the same. Which then means our decisions on how we respond to it should not necessarily be based on the fact that we're trying to remove the objective facts on the ground that lead to the controversies. That would be a logical approach, a charter, the codes, and all of those kind of things. Because you will do all of this, but perceptions continue. It seems to me that we need to find a formula that also addresses perceptions within South Africa about its own business And that will have to do, unfortunately, with a big, long, complex subject of finding national reconciliation within South Africa itself. Helping South Africa find a national consensus, and we hope that the National Planning Commission will help us with that. But also, you will have to do with what you do on the African continent to change perceptions there. And I think it will have to do with a lot of smart diplomacy that is done by South Africa as a collective business and government to ensure that you assure the region that this big state next to them does not have a hegemonic or negatively hegemonic conditions. Because for as long as you're a big state and you play a role, there will always be a worry. And therefore, we need better education, better engagement, better diplomacy, and better leadership across the board. Thank you very much.
Dr. Zondi, thank you very much. I think we can open the floor for a round of questions and comments.
Thank you very much. I want to start with perception. Perception is a dangerous thing. Like, if a company should fail or do something bad, the perception is on the whole country. The only way to get that is diplomacy, promoting, marketing, and that's something that our different agents in different countries have to look at. Otherwise, we'll close ourselves down. Another thing is, our only way to really promote our business in Africa, through Africa. But unfortunately, we're a bit late now, because the Chinese have moved in, and they're dumping all businesses, everything. You can go to any little town in Africa, they've got their product there, they're closing down factories in that country, and we can't export the way we can or used to. Our other problem is, if we look at Europe and the East, taxes. If we want to export wine to India, the taxes are 60%. But the stuff that we import from them, only 20%. So, our product, we are treated, our companies that are exporting is being treated very bad through taxes. On the other hand, if you take the European market, they all, the farmers, about everybody being sponsored by the government. So we're not competitive. So that is just a few pointers that I want to light out and tell you what is our position. And if we can concentrate on those points, we might change the whole exporting exercise from South Africa. Thank you.
Another question? Are we satisfied?
No, thanks, Dr. Zondi. I must apologize. I only got the tail end of the presentation. I had to attend to some questions but I want to link up with the three scenarios you just mentioned to what Catherine referred to earlier, the political system. That were adopted by American companies during the 80s. Part of the response to apartheid, which was then followed on by the other things that followed. We're not getting to that. The point is, it's an interesting scenario that has been raised, because even the solution principles were voluntarily adopted by companies doing business in South Africa. Of course, those that stayed, that did not necessarily pull out part of the sanctions draft. But within the Sullivan principles, they had a set of things that they said they would act differently as opposed to the apartheid or as opposed to South African companies. There was a deliberate attempt, for instance, on their part to do what is today called affirmative action, in terms of giving some form of preferential treatment to black employees in terms of skills, in terms of education, in terms of better salaries, abolishing job reservation within the Apple company. So they had a set of measures they took in terms of the Suleiman principles. I want your thoughts on that really. To respond broadly to is that part of, could that be part of the charter you're referring to? That's my long question then.
Area that you spoke about, the relationship between business and government. That's no clear that you're talking about. What is your experience of African companies outside of our borders? Do they experience the same kind of situation? And my own view is, I think that has been contested the statement that Tommy made, that's the situation in South Africa. And I think there needs to be quite a bit of evidence produced on why such a statement after 17 years keep on coming up. Because one gets the impression that it's been asked that governments must go and reach out to end the stalemate. You don't hear, we are volunteering ourselves to come and end the stalemate as an entity, as a business entity in South Africa. You just hear that one side, you never hear the other way around. That because then there is us also now, and we would want to do the following thing. Why is that the case? Is that situation occurs? Because I really grapple in understanding what it is that there is such a situation. I really like your thoughts on that, because this one of the kind of the things that it goes with that surely has got to be addressed. The blame game, just back to the silver cat, obviously has to be to be. But when you hear the Minister of Finance speak, yes, we saw it together with us and so on. Now, there's very contradicting things, all of these things.
I think Dr. Zonnie can respond.
Thank you very much. Perception may require marketing. It may require public diplomacy. And marketing is only one component of it. One of the things that Africa does not do well is what is called public diplomacy. South Africa does not communicate. It is very, very poor in communicating on foreign policy. Even when we need to communicate, it's very obvious we don't communicate. For example, when we were this Syria resolution, and it was a tricky resolution, and I pick it up on a Saturday that it come through very straightforward, but the question has been raised. What's the nature of diplomacy that you've got to have to undermine the other side and find things to cause controversy to the other side? And I write to the spokesperson, for example, and I say, this thing is all over the place, but I look at your website, it's not up on the website. It's not going to be up, it's only up by midday on Monday. So the controversy would have gone on, and it's a very big challenge. So people aren't able to communicate with South African middle class, right? English speaking, what you do. And you can't definitely communicate with the rest of South Africa. Forget about us communicating to the rest of us. We just do not communicate on the continent. It's bad. Really, really weak. I do not know where the problem is. If I suggest, and that is my suggestion,
I suggest the South African, the people who manage South African, the population of South African foreign policy, especially at DECO, have not sufficiently understood the importance of using all tools of the government and using them efficiently. Because if we're going to maintain our position in BRIC, we must really behave like Brazil. We must really behave like India. They are being adept at using the tools of the government. So, for example, South Africa is a host to students that are expected to number about 2 million who study in South Africa, and they come from about 41 countries. And those are your ambassadors, your friend ambassadors. So you must engage them. They know the country better than someone who can counter the human needs. They can change a wrong perception for a good perception. But do we engage them? Do we offer them any assistance? Do we give them visitor programs? Do we put them in visa programs? We don't. Is this most cost effective? True. We don't use it. I can assure you there is no interaction at all between South Africa and the Africa that is represented in South Africa. 41 countries. And that's civil society. And it's because you are used to one group diplomats in this age stage only. And don't realize that hosting this number of people here is a huge source of soft power. And that's a pity, it doesn't matter. And currently the number of African businesses are now based in South Africa. Do we engage them? No. If we don't engage them, how do we clear that? I don't know. Issue a statement once in a while, and it does not happen. It seems to me, that's why I'm pressed by saying, if the whole thing assumes that we have really gone through a process of strategically thinking again about how, where we want to be in the world, what we want to do, and how we want to play a role in Africa, and what is going through the paradigm, the doctrine, the tools that we are going to use to get there. Unfortunately, that is not happening. I was just hoping that with the discussion process on the towards the white paper, we will have an opportunity to confront those challenges and try and help our country to think a lot more strategically about all of this. So I agree, perception goes to the background, and a lot of activities to do that. But some of the things we need to remove our own the objective conditions for those perceptions to persist. Now, I was on a plane to the after short ride, sending a team of people all there. They made a very, very classical mistake, terrible, terrible mistake. These are all young black people. Two colored guys, three Indian guys, and about six or seven Africans. The supervisor is white. And the white people. And you're making simply reporting that. I'm sure, I'm really certain that ShopRite had a huge choice of people that they could use. Not because they want to engineer anything, but they want to send a signal that doesn't confirm. Because now, how I'm working on it, it brought you to my attention by a millionaire portal in our camp. Congolese reporter. Those are just neighbors like the rest of us. There is the guy. That simple thing, so business is fact, need to think very carefully and not take things for granted. So there's quite a few things we need to do. When it comes to the Chinese, and the Chinese are really massive South Africa out, and the African continent is a serious issue. And increasingly, the Brazilians are very aggressive on the African continent. And the Indians also. These are our partners, but they're very aggressive in doing this. And they still use their businesses to do this, but they're very clever. The guy negotiating on behalf of the big Brazilian conglomerate, Vane, in Mozambique, is actually Mozambican born Brazilian. They're clever. They know what the meaning is. Because the Mozambicans is actually the affiliated with the Mozambicans. But the Brazilian has. They often have a similar situation like ours, a multiracial society, but then use this to their advantage. We do not. So the Chinese know how to play that game because they manage the political system. The Chinese advantage is that there is greater consensus between business and government over wide issues. In South Africa, it's not the case. So the Chinese use that to their advantage, such that they bring a better compact between the two. And this is why. And the practices of Chinese companies are much worse than those who ever find in South Africa. But that is besides the point. But perceptions aren't based on studies on objective facts. And that is a big challenge. I think in response to the questions which really are just talking about South African business taking initiative. I already mentioned that South African business needs to think carefully about how the countries that it is dealing with, do social political analysis seriously, and act smartly. And not act as if it was a blank state, and there are no preconceived ideas, there is no issue between the old South Africa and Africa. And not act as if there is no history of white colonialism and black oppression. They should be interviewing, in my view, smart in doing this. At least what they could do is to think about the educational risks, which means the language of business. Yes, bad reputation is a risk. And therefore, do something to mitigate it. Would you not simply say, as Clive said, would you all think that I can all the time? I think there is also that big problem of compliance with you right. And it's individual business to say so. But of course, perceptions are not generated by good business. Are generated by bad business. But they're generated for the less. So we can't say we're doing right, and therefore it's okay. If business number two is doing wrong, you are also better affected. And we've seen certain businesses being shortchanged very significantly, very badly. In countries like Congo, South Africa, and others, not because of the sins, their own sins, but because of what others have done. So I was going to challenge Clive and say, if this government is doing well, then they take it upon themselves, these members of the business leadership of South Africa, to make sure that all other countries do it. Or self-regulation. Take the initiative yourself. Think about the condition of this. And think about what you role in Africa is not merely about extracting profit, but about contributing to a stable market by the business language, right through the continent. And I think that could be part of the charter. And with regard to what the sense is out there of South African business, I illustrated in this case of this Congo system. Generally, there's divided views. There's people who love South African business because it has helped a lot, especially in supermarkets and others. But I think people are very worried about the things that I've just mentioned. And especially in our immediate region, because the apartheid state destabilized the industry. But people remember that very, very well. Which is why the whole of the South African business, the whole of the South African enterprise is that while there's a huge expectation for the South African to come in, when the South African comes in, there's a huge amount of apprehension. So don't understand it. They invite us, but what do I think? They think what or how to do something. They invite us to fill the candidate for the AU Commission chair. But what we feel is they take it hegemonic community. We don't understand it. It's a metaphor for the fact that they are finished business, they are gifted as peers, even though we recognize their role as a regional power to help it. And the worst thing we do in South Africa, that's our own government business, is not to recognize that they each that. And make over romanticize one part over the other. And that will be an opportunity to resolve those questions once and for all, because they are a condition of this force and they undermine our strategic goals and strategic objectives.
Thank you. I think we are just after one. Should we take another round of questions, if there are any?
Please, if you have questions.
Sorry, back to perception. Just one thing that worries me, and that is that apartheid is gone now. But we mustn't let the world think that it is apartheid with just black on white and white on black on that. The best person, if you've got a race to run and you're the owner of the horse, you're going to put the best jockey on. You're not going to put somebody on that's going to fall off. That is very important. And we must, talking about Brazilian, we must be like the Brazilian. You get light Brazilians, you get very dark Brazilians. They're all Brazilian and they are unified. Talk about Mozambique, they talk their language is Portuguese and Brazilian as well. What's making Brazilian very strong? On the agriculture side, they've got Abrapa, Research Center for Agriculture. They've got over 200 doctors in that section. We are killing our research, there's hardly anybody left. And they're taking over Africa with their ways and their thoughts with agriculture, and they're planting and they're going in Mozambique, they call it going all over Africa. And that's something that we could have contributed to Africa, but we're killing the farmers. We're stopping it. That was supposed to be one of our biggest exports, and that is our knowledge in Africa farming, but they are so far ahead. I've been there, we can go back and get them here that we can learn from.
Thank you very much. I also want to add the fact that there is something else that the Brazilians have done to weaken the defense of their colonial past, for being used to store their processes. They have made both the Brazilian government and business have dedicated a lot of resources and energy, very energetic, very upfront, to reducing poverty in Brazil. And as a result, they've been able to reduce poverty by 19%. They were able to do that in a period of 5 years. And it was not just that, but it was business as well. Of course, the Brazilian business was also inherited from the colonial system. But it used its fight against poverty to atone for the sins of the past. In South Africa, it's a different thing. The business has simply not made a case that it is in South Africa, unfortunately. So it has to perpetuate its past by not being seen to do significant work to transform the social space so that you remove the loop, to remove the impression that they want to perpetuate the past. Similarly, in slightly different cases in China, they have taken 400 million people out of poverty. 400 million. That's huge. And it seems to me if business wanted to change things once and for all, destroy the two nation dilemma, and consign apartheid to dust the way it belongs, then it must distinctly act in very energetically and decisively and purposefully to undo the problem. And it seems to me that what you often see is a reluctant a participation, which for me I think is third, and I think it's short-sighted on the part of some of them, because it is the long term of this country that business contributes significantly to removing the inequality internally, so that we can then present a United States global. But of course, government has a significant role in ensuring that this business in that direction and it works together very closely. And without that, we will be divided. And apartheid will continue to hold up as a psychology for a long period of time. But apartheid is there by a psychology on both sides, both those who are privileged by it and those who are affected by it. And sooner we accept that step, the better. Because if we don't face the demon, now face others who use it to destroy it. Like that, they are doing what is popular and elsewhere. Thank you.
One more question.
Well, of course, these points are very, what do you call it?
your point that you are raising is also very provocative in a positive way. I'm not saying. You know, it brings me back to the much, much earlier presentation that we had by yourself. And that is in listening to what you said earlier on and listening to the other two presentations also and listening to Orlando's response. The question that then arises is unfortunately back to the 90s up to 1994. And that is the nature of our political settlement in South Africa still working now? And I'm not advocating that we, you know, have to solve the battle with guns and all of that stuff. There was a choice that was made. We could have chosen the other one and also, but another choice was made. Because everything that you are saying goes back to the kind of society that we come from, and that sometimes in many of our quarters people don't want us to refer to it, but the vestiges of them is so much around in how we moving forward. So you know the parliamentarians of the system up till today, they become very angry when they see us. And it's got to do with that little invasion that was there in the absence of the real president of the day. And so you can carry on in the different structures that are there. You will then see the responses. And what is interesting, there's no differentiation between who it is. Trade unions of the rest of Africa, they respond to Kosatu in the same way, hostility. The MPs of Africa respond in the same way, hostility. I would imagine the business community probably does the same. Government would obviously have the same reception. So I really want to ask, are you really saying to us that this settlement of ours is still wanting us, and this settlement has got to do for the kind of things that you are saying? And the second thing also is in South Africa we've got a lot of private security. It's just everywhere. In many of our areas are in fact the emphasis is far more on the private security than the actual police in the country. And doesn't that mean that is legitimacy that has been given to cross the border and to then, if we've got so much power here, we might as well just apply this power outside of the borders of South Africa also. So I'm really interested to find out that situation. There's an interesting case that of Kulumani that has gone to I think the American court, and there's been a very interesting response from the government there, and a critique on the fact that the businesses must accept that they've done very, very terrible things during the apartheid years, and they've now offered this settlement of money. Why do we need to have that settlement outside of the country? Why don't we have a voluntary settlement inside of South Africa? Because if we all accept that we must continue to repair, there has got to be overages that are made also.
I guess the issues you're raising are standard of debate of material of time about whether the issues raise questions about the nature of the broadcast settlement. I've actually made the point that part of the challenge is causes us to debate sometimes unnecessarily about lots of things. It is to do with the fact that we have not resolved certain things that we have to resolve. The process of nation building is thought to be a generation now. It's 50 years, but we hope it will be 5 years. That typical South African optimism. We should not be
slow down doing taking that process, because if you don't, the radical or conservative, whichever side you want to choose, elements would play on those unfinished stories and trick on new thoughts. And that's actually what I think about the radicalism of the new Marxist platform that was established by a few activists. Headed to emotions about an unfair compromise and stuff and stuff. And that is the same thing I think about the some of the activities of solidarity changing on for example as well. You know, headed to these extremist positions parties, because they flourish parties, because we have those who are moderate, those who are level-headed and logical, want to build a better country, have not worked hard enough to ensure that the nation building project itself actually happens. I think the challenge is that we shifted from nation building to implementation, policy implementation, to implement policies without a safe ground now. And it is a false premise. So my challenge is the premise we started to build under Mandela. By the time the term was ending, there was kind of assumption that done because it's been announced by Bishop Tutu as a rainbow nation. But it was a proclamation of what to come, not what it had to happen. And then on the Kulumani case, I think it's just one option that gets used, which is to use the doors. If we enable African citizens everywhere to approach a regional court, a standard court or over any matter, so that your judicial officers were qualified to adjudicate over material breaches of any particular code of regulation global, you really do empower them to participate in enforcing the conflict between business and government generally. But then we have to apply to all things. So all of the member countries of project and business from China, from Britain, to India, and so on. That's an option too. But it's just one of the many options that people are giving to everyone. Thank you very much.
Shall we wrap it up, Jay? And then thank you, Dr. Zondi, for a very insightful presentation. And I think also the key question is the one on how we build ourselves. And that will ultimately also inform how we act outside of South Africa. So thank you very much. Jay, over to you.
I'm not the tallest tree around. Not exactly the highest skyscraper in the city. So, thank you so much, honorable members. Let me perhaps just in wrapping up. There's quite an interesting issue raised by honorable Ilof, and that indeed speaks to the issues that have not been completely resolved in our country. But I find it a bit troubling that, and I may very well have misinterpreted what he said, but the immediate impression almost was that there's some policy of killing white people, or alternatively that there's a black on white, the killing that is taking place. I sure hope that that's not what the honorable member. No, that's fine. You spoke about farming. Okay. Are you talking about farm killings?
No. The business on the farm.
Oh, killing the business. Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
Research.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. No. Thanks for clearing that up. I was a bit. I was a bit jittery on that one. No, thanks. Thanks for clearing that up. I guess, honourable members, indeed there is a process taking place within TTI. In fact, in the portfolio committee, there are engagements around this particular issue. Of course, what DTI does and what we do, looking in particular at the conduct of South Africa's foreign policy and the conduct of business in that context, in terms of how it affects us going forward as a country in pursuit of that foreign policy and objectives, is indeed it's work in progress. Hopefully, we will confer with the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry on this particular matter to get to grips with how far they are. And having received this briefing, briefings, surely we are better placed to listen and engage with better insight, with a little bit of more information and knowledge on the subject matter. But also a bit better equipped to arrive at particular conclusions going forward. This will certainly not be the last engagement on this issue. We will certainly have to engage because the implications or the ramifications for either leaving the situation unabated or making the wrong interventions are beyond comprehension. Again, let me stress the fact that economic diplomacy is an extension of our foreign policy, an extension of our domestic priorities, or at the least a tool with which to abolish our own internal contradictions as a country characterized by the two worlds, the two economies. And as such, it's to us very, very, very critical. Because the ultimate analysis, that is the function of foreign policy. Foreign policy is not an end in itself. I mean, the conduct of foreign policy, statecraft, so to speak, diplomacy, is not an end in itself. It's a means to an end. And so it must indeed help us to achieve our infrastructure development. It must help us to achieve our nation-building objectives. It must help us to achieve a wide range of issues that we've set ourselves to achieve in South Africa. And let me take this opportunity again to thank the presenters, all of you, Dr. Zondi, Dr. Dukok, Catherine, and where is the Standard Bank? What is your name again? Yes. Well, let me thank him in absentia and the rest of the people, PMG and so on. Thank you for following us. You are a very important... you see, without you, there is no record of this meeting. So thank you very much. Honorable members, let me just make an announcement or two. One, we might be required to come to Cape Town for one day during our constituency period. No, I'm not asking for a response. The problem is, perhaps I should just say, the problem is, we would be